It's 9:06. You're listening to New Hampshire Public Radio.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The definitive cause of autism remains a mystery, but recently there was a bit of a breakthrough. According to a study published in the venerable New England Journal of Medicine, autism develops in the womb long before a child is born. And that, the authors say, could lead to better understanding of the roots of this brain disorder, factors that likely include genetics, a father who is older, and complications like infections during pregnancy. Discovering prenatal markers of autism could also help parents get earlier treatment for their kids, which appears to greatly help these children. And these findings come at a critical time when new Centers for Disease Control numbers show autism cases ever rising in America to a record 1 in every 68 kids diagnosed as somewhere on the autism spectrum. Today in The Exchange, new findings about a growing issue, American children with autism. Let's hear from you. What do you make of this new research and new numbers? How do you see autism affecting Granite State families, schools, communities? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests in studio are Dr. Teresa Bolick. She's a psychologist and behavior analyst specializing in autism spectrum disorders. She frequently consults with schools in New England and has served on the New Hampshire Legislative Council on Autism Spectrum Disorders. And Dr. Bolick, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Joining us by phone is Julie Erdely. She's Program Manager for Communication Services at the Stern Center for Language and Learning in Williston, Vermont. She specializes in teaching people with autism, and she serves on the Vermont Autism Task Force. And Julie Erdely, good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
And joining us from Hanover, Dr. Stephen Mott. He's a developmental cognitive neurologist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center and medical director of the Child Development Center at CHAD. And Dr. Mott, a pleasure to have you. Thank you for your time as well.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, and Dr. Mott, let's just start with you and get a basic definition out of the way. How would you briefly define what autism is?
I would define autism as a neurodevelopmental condition that involves social interactive deficits in terms of relating to peers, as well as a communication disorder that involves both nonverbal as well as verbal communication. And many times this is associated in the autism spectrum with restricted, repetitive types of behaviors.
Can you give us a little more on that autism spectrum? Because we're going to be talking about that a lot today. What exactly does that mean, Dr. Mott?
Well, it really is definitional based on the new diagnostic and statistical criterion. It used to be that one would differentiate between Asperger's and pervasive developmental disorders and autism and low-functioning, high-functioning. And now with the new fifth version, we look at the spectrum from those that are very much involved in terms of their social interactive and communication deficits with very basic repetitive types of behaviors to those children that are much higher functioning. And rather than identifying them as individual subgroups, we're now combining them all as a broad autism spectrum.
And is it fair to call this a brain disorder, Dr. Mott?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And Julie Erdely, Dr. Mott gave us the clinical definition. What sorts of behaviors or challenges do you see among the kids that you work with at the Stern Center?
Some of the primary things that happen occur around sort of rigid thinking, a need for predictability in life. So the rigid thinking can present itself in terms of, when something doesn't happen the way I want it to happen, I can shut down, or I might have explosive behaviors, things that are related just to that style of thinking. And we also see challenges with communication. If the communication is impaired and therefore very frustrating for an individual, they might go ahead and carry out a task without communicating about it in an expected way and leaving people around them somewhat confused or bewildered.
How do you define what's normal sort of kid behavior, Julie, or discern what's quote-unquote normal and what isn't? I mean, listening to you, you know, a lot of kids explode when something doesn't happen the way they want it to happen, especially younger
sure.
kids. So, you know, what's autistic and what isn't?
Well, you know, that's why we have this lovely diagnostic criteria to help us with that. But when it comes to intervention and providing interventions, you know, it's essentially, if we look at what's effective for people who have autism, those same interventions are effective for people who don't.
And we'll talk definitely about treatment and interventions and so forth later. But what are your thoughts, Dr. Bolick, on this idea of a spectrum of behaviors and the question of how we diagnose, how we define autism? It's pretty broad. It isn't just like cancer or, you know, some other type of ailment.
It is very broad. And for those of us who have been in the field for a long time, we've seen some very nice advances in our understanding of assessment. In the past, we might just have a child in the office and look at that child and talk to the parents, and we think we had a pretty good idea. But now we do have some gold standards of diagnoses. We understand that the process must be multidisciplinary, and there are some practice parameters that have been determined by the American Academy of Pediatrics and by the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry groups.
What does that mean, practice parameters?
A practice parameter is a guideline that has been developed by review of research from multiple sources, and looking at what it is that the responsible pediatrician or neurologist or psychologist should do in practice. So these are the things that define our best practices.
What are your thoughts on the question of, you know, again, we talk about this spectrum disorder from, you know, very minor issues to very major issues. Are we defining autism too broadly? Are we catching up too many kids in this definition?
You know, Laura, I remember back in 1995 when Dr. Stanley Greenspan, who was one of the leaders in the field, famously said, if we have any suspicion at all that this child has autism, we need to hit the ground running with treatment. And as Ms. Erdely said a few moments ago, we're not going to hurt anybody by supporting their communication, their play, by supporting adaptive behavior. So it's really better in the beginning to make a mistake in over-identification than it is to miss somebody who might be helped by early intervention.
I'd love your thoughts on that too, Dr. Mott. Better to over-identify than miss someone.
I certainly believe that's true in terms of the early intervention from birth to three, where the identification of the concern through screening is most important. But I feel as they get older and they're in the school system that it is more important to define what their actual deficits are within the confines of the autism spectrum regarding their behavioral issues, regarding their communication issues, regarding the way they interact socially with their friends, with their teachers, with the school as a whole, outside the school, at home. And therefore, I feel that we should be more rigid in our definition. And I am concerned about the blurring of the lines, because ultimately it's how the physician who is seeing that child in their office interprets those guidelines. And I think that the new guidelines leave a lot of room for overdiagnosis, but we'll talk about that.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. And I'd love your thoughts, too, on that, Julie Erdely, and then I want to invite our listeners to join us. Go ahead, Julie.
Well, I have to say I'm in agreement about over, you know, especially in those early years, it's better to err on the side of let's go ahead and intervene, because early intervention is so important. And I think that as we get into the older ages, identifying those needs, those communication needs, or those specific behavioral needs for all kids is really important. So regardless of the label that is used for it, if we can if we can teach to those communication deficits or if we can teach to those behavioral needs and help give people strategies that help them be successful, that's the most important part.
Our phone number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. What do you make of some of the new numbers showing autism cases ever rising in this country? The CDC says now a record 1 in every 68 kids is somewhere on the autism spectrum. Also, there's been new research showing that autism starts possibly in utero. What are your thoughts on this new research, new numbers? How do you see autism affecting Granite State families, communities, and schools? Again, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. So I touched on the new numbers, and I think we're starting to go there anyway. So, Dr. Bolick, let's go there. What do you make of these new numbers from the CDC? Just a couple weeks ago, 1 in 68 American kids, I find that just jaw-dropping.
Well, I do too. When I first started practicing, the numbers were 0.5 in every 10,000. You should see her face. Her jaw is dropping.
Yeah.
I think that, as Dr. Mott said, there may be some overdiagnosis, particularly at the milder ends of the spectrum among older folks. I think there also is something we need to be very aware of, and that is that an autism diagnosis is a ticket to services. And for some of our youngsters whose challenges are a little harder to define, they may not qualify for services through their insurance companies or through their school systems if they do not have a very clear-cut diagnosis. So, unfortunately, we live in a deficit-based service delivery system, and if you don't have something that qualifies you, it's hard to get help.
So is there an incentive for parents to have their kids diagnosed as autistic so that they can get help from the schools?
I think there sometimes is.
More to follow up in just a moment. More on autism. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR is looking for challenges facing colleges and students with a special series, A Matter of Degrees, considers falling enrollment numbers and rising debt loans and the effects it all has on the New Hampshire economy. Join us all next week for A Matter of Degrees on NHPR and at nhpr.org. This series made possible with support from the Dairy Field School and Edvest in You. More on autism on the rise on The Exchange at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, The Fight for Legal Rights for Animals. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Seacoast Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, orthopedics and team physicians for the UNH Wildcats, providing evaluations and surgical interventions for athletic injuries, sosmed.org. An SIT graduate institute offering internationally focused master's degree programs, hosting an open house at the Brattleboro campus May 2nd. Information at sit.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at some of the latest research and new numbers surrounding autism. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Twitter or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. All one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And before we go to our listeners, all of you, Dr. Mott, I did want to ask you about one other new piece concerning autism. There's new research that autism starts in utero. This is the study I referenced earlier in the New England Journal of Medicine. Give us a little more on that, please. What did researchers find?
Well, Dr. Corshane out at San Diego found was that the architecture of the cells in the cortex, or thinking part of the brain, were labeled somewhat abnormally with a genetic stain for certain neurons, and found that it showed a patchy pattern in children that had autism. And this was a preliminary study of less than 15 brains where they actually looked at this architecture. And it was a high variability of where these patches were, which they drew conclusions as to why there is a spectrum and such a heterogeneous presentation of autism. But and this occurs during the second trimester in pregnancy. So that's why the concern that this is occurring in utero.
So is there a genetic test for autism at this point in time, Dr. Mott, like there are for other conditions such as Down syndrome?
Well, there's not a genetic test per se for autism. There are a whole host of genes that have been associated with autism, but there isn't a specific test. And that's one of the problems with the diagnosis of autism. If there were a test, then we wouldn't have this controversy and blurring of lines. It's really a clinical diagnosis.
Yeah, all the issues that all of you raised earlier. Let's go to our listeners. Lots of people who want to jump in on our conversation. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Dawn's calling first from Lowell. Hi, Dawn. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. My son was diagnosed with sensory processing disorder at the age of 2.5. And I was just wondering where that falls by clinical definition in the autism spectrum, if it does at all.
And how does that affect his personality, Dawn, or his daily life?
He's, high functioning, although there are implications with his, socially, definitely he's delayed, and it also affects his gross motor skills, as well as it did fine motor skills, especially when he was, a toddler.
Yeah, and how old is he now, Dawn, if I could ask?
He's 12.
He's 12, okay. How's he doing?
Very well, but, there's struggles that kind of come up as he grows and gets older and, academic challenges and social challenges change, he comes up and struggles with it more so than your typical child.
Sure. Well, Dawn, good luck to you, and thanks for calling in. And Dr. Bullock, what do you think about some of the issues that our caller raises?
One of the additions to the diagnostic manual in its latest revision was the inclusion of sensory differences under the restricted and repetitive behaviors category. So the Psychiatric Association is now recognizing that some people with ASD do have sensory differences. But we also know that there are a whole host of people who have sensory differences who do not have autism spectrum disorders.
What is sensory difference? What does that mean exactly? Can you give us a practical example?
Sure. We have youngsters who scream bloody murder when they have a tag in the back of their T-shirt or the seam in their socks doesn't feel right to them.
Well, they can't stand wool, or I can't stand wool at this point either, though, so,
Dr. Margaret Bowman, one of the neurologists who's done so much important work on autism, once said, in previous generations, there would have been a grandmother at home who would sew a silk lining in your wool sweater so it wouldn't scratch you.
Right. So is this really autism, or is it just, people have certain sensitivities? Again, at this point, I don't like wool anymore. I used to know someone who couldn't stand fire drill sounds. So is that autism or?
Well, think about it. If you have sensory sensitivities and you can talk, you can say, I can't stand wool anymore.
Got it.
If you have sensory differences and you do not yet talk, you have to scream.
All right. Well, good luck with your son, Donna. Thank you for the call. Again, the number 1-800-892.
Laura.
Yes, go ahead. Let
Laura,
me just finish giving the number, Dr. Mott. Okay, hang on. I was just in the middle of the number, but let me just finish giving it, and then I'd love to hear from you. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Got it. Go ahead, Dr. Mott.
I'm sorry. One of the premises with children with autism that we see is that they like sameness. They thrive on sameness. And sometimes that sameness is their sensory feelings. Sometimes it's an object. Sometimes it's a series of steps that they must go through. it's almost in an obsessive fashion or obsessive-compulsive fashion. But it's not a – so any change or variation in that is because they're so rigid in their desire for sameness is how that separates them into the autism spectrum. And they get very irritated by that change, whether it be wool, whether it be not being able to play with that particular toy. But it's not a sensory, per se, disorder.
So it's the level of rigidity, Dr. Mott? Like one kid may say, gee, I don't like having to switch from activity A to activity B, or I don't like the fact that I have to share the toy with you. But eventually they deal with it, whereas the child with autism can't deal with it?
Initially, they can't, and that's where much of the work in terms of therapy and education will help them in terms of being able to accept that change. But those that are most rigid about it, it takes a very long time for them to accept that difference. And there actually are studies that show that certain subgroups of kids with autism actually can perceive subtle differences even more detailed than we can. I always think of my sister who looks at a wall of red paint, and to me it's a wall of red paint, but she sees all the different variations of the color red there. And it very much, that's how the degree of rigidity in some of these kids. So that very subtle difference in change, whether it be smell, whether it be taste, whether it be texture, whether it be a toy, again, whether it be a series of steps, they see that change, they feel that change, and they get frustrated. And that's what's perceived as a sensory, but from a neurologic sense, that's not a sensory processing condition.
Julie, I'd love your thoughts on that, because I'm sure these are issues that come up with the kids that you work with every day.
Yes, they are. And I'm not sure that I could weigh in on the neurological side of things. But
no,
I
want to know, how does it play out in the kids that you work with? Yeah.
Well, so you'll see some repetitive behaviors sometimes, or you'll see an escalation in behaviors that occurs that can be helped by, say, providing some sensory input, such as pressure in the joints or things like that, that help to alleviate the problem, make the person feel calmer, whether it's the need for sameness or whether it's a certain physical sensation they're feeling. You might see anything from, getting up and bolting out of the room to rocking in a chair to finger mannerisms or hand flapping, that sort of thing. All of these things can be helped if, by giving replacement things, things that you can allow for short breaks if somebody needs to leave the room, but then having them come back and teaching the communication that goes along with that at the same time as giving alternate sensory activities that can keep the communication happening and keep the person engaged.
Are the children, Julie, at the Stern Center also part of the regular public school system, or are they mostly at the Stern Center?
Oh, no. They're part of the public school system. The Stern Center sees all kinds of learners.
Sure.
I particularly like people with autism, but we see all kinds of learners here, and all of my learners are involved in the school systems.
So when a child comes to the Stern Center for help with language and learning, and again, it's the Stern Center for Language and Learning, how do you help them hang on to those skills when they're in that regular public school setting where they may not be getting as close attention as they are with you?
Sure. Well, I think one of the main things that we offer that's a little bit unique is our social thinking services, which is taking the idea of social skills training that traditionally used to happen and making it a more, as Ami Klin would put it, sort of a real-time naturalistic intervention in which the person is participating in learning about the skill that they're trying to learn in an interactive, hands-on, sort of game-based way with peers. And so the difference between that is that when they experience it in that naturalistic learning tends to have a better result for generalization across different environments than than the sort of direct skill training type of learning. So we do a lot of that social thinking work here.
Our phone number again for you to join us with your questions and comments about autism, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. We want your thoughts on this new research that we're hearing about concerning autism beginning in utero. Also, new numbers from the CDC showing that now one in every 68 kids is diagnosed somewhere on the autism spectrum. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. And Allison's waiting in Portsmouth. Hi, Allison, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering if your panel had heard anything about a nutritional diet called GAPS. It's called Gut and Psychology Syndrome, and it's done by a woman. She started it, Natasha McBride, and she believes that healing the gut makes a huge difference in the psychological part or the symptoms of autism. And I wonder if anybody had heard anything about that and what their thoughts were on it.
So a special diet that includes special foods, Allison, organic
yes,
foods or no sugar?
Yeah.
Or...
Yep, all that and more. It's a pretty strict diet that has different stages. But empirically seen that it's really helped children with autism.
And is this something you've personally experienced with, Allison?
I have, yes, yep. I have, not for autism, but for other issues. And I've seen a huge difference in myself on it. So I was wondering if they had heard anything about it.
Okay, great. Well, I'd love to ask everybody about this, actually. And to you first, I think, Dr. Bolick, every time we do a program on autism, we do hear from people asking about various dietary factors, whether it's organic food, sugar, gluten. What do you think? Is there any sort of a dietary link between either causes of autism or help for people who already have autism?
One of the problems that we have, because this is a spectrum, is that it's very, very difficult to do research on what may be the true effect of a diet. And as you can imagine, when a family goes to the trouble of changing the family's entire eating style in order to accommodate these kind of differences, there's a huge hope and expectation that it's going to make a difference. At this point, I don't know about the specific diet that Allison is talking about, but in general, the gluten-free and casein-free diets that have been talked about for quite a while have not held up as evidence-based practices when we look at controlled studies. That's not to say that they might not help some people. We just don't have the research capacity to figure it out entirely yet.
Is casein a milk derivative?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And love your thoughts on this too, Dr. Mott, because we often hear from people with questions about diet and links to autism.
Yes, this is a very common question that I run into in clinical practice. And I agree with Dr. Bolick that there really has not been any research that has shown that any particular diet is better than another. And I am not familiar with the diet that the mother is talking about. But what I encourage my patients when they come up with some new diet or new vitamin treatment to share that with me. And many times when I really look into it, what the proponents of the diet state in terms of studies really are anecdotes and are not really good controlled research studies to show that they make that difference. That being said, there are children that have sensitivities to foods and allergies to foods like any other child, and those could result in behavioral outbursts because the child with autism can't express themselves in any other way. So if there's a family history of gluten sensitivity or lactose intolerance, those things really need to be looked at. But overall, relative to diets, it's making sure that they get adequate vitamins.
Well, and Julie,
nutrition.
I want to hear from you, too, on this, too. But another question for you, Dr. Mott. You know, we talked a minute ago about the new research showing that the autism could be beginning in utero. Did that research shed any new light on the causes, you know, whether it's environmental or genetic or otherwise?
Well, there have been other studies preceding that indicate that the cortex or thinking part of the brain is different in children with autism. Initially, Dr. Bauman and Kemper at Harvard talked about very tightly packed cells that were not as mature in various parts of the brain. And then Dr. Casanova down in Georgia showed that there were many column differences. And these are all occurring as the developing cortex. Now, there has been research that links individuals mothers that take the SSRIs for depression, that maybe the exposure to the serotonergic type agents during pregnancy could result in autism. There is that correlation. But at the same time, they have found a gene that is positive linked with autism as well as with depression. So what hasn't been looked at is the subgroup of children that have autism, that have the exposure to the SSRI, potentially they have that gene that expressed itself in the mother as depression and now expressing itself as autism in the child. So we still have this nature versus nurture question, whether it's the environment or whether it's the genes.
Wow. And so, yeah, you're showing us how complicated it is. So first you look at the study, Dr. Mott, and you say, wow, okay, it's the antidepressants. But then when you look deeper, maybe not.
Correct. Could be the genetic predisposition.
Well, here's a quick email that just came in from Maureen in Concord. She said, I've heard that there's a link between multiple ultrasounds and autism. Is there a connection, Dr. Mott, to you?
This has been looked at, and the research has not shown that there is a distinct correlation, but the question is the multiple uses of very high intensity ultrasound imaging, if it's going to affect an area, it would affect this outer cortex area, because that's the closest to where the transducer of the ultrasound is located. But right now, that research hasn't panned out to be confirming.
Okay, Maureen, thank you for the email. And we'll take your emails after a short break. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. More on autism and the latest research and numbers in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the legal fight to grant personhood status to animals. Then a conversation with California Congressman Henry Waxman. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Franklin Pierce University, offering their MBA in leadership degree online and on-site. Information online at franklinpierce.edu. And from Harvest Capital, proud sponsor of the Entrepreneurs Foundation of New Hampshire, helping improve the quality of life and health in our communities. More at harvestcap.com. 940, this is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, New Hampshire is likely to raise the gas tax for the first time in more than two decades. We'll look at that tomorrow on the show. Today in The Exchange, an update on autism, new numbers, new research. Join us now with your thoughts, questions, comments. 1-800-892-6477 is our phone number. Find us on Twitter. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can send us an email as well, exchange@nhpr.org. And Dr. Teresa Bolick, Julie Erdely, and Dr. Stephen Mott. Let's go back to our listeners now who are waiting. And Anne is joining us from Rumney. Hi, Anne. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning. I am a grandmother of an Asperger syndrome young man who's just turned 18. And my daughter, they live in Australia. She had to find all her services herself at first to going into a private school, et cetera, where he could get one-on-one and so on. And she's managed to get him through this. As an aside, his father tends to be Asperger too, as she calls it. But you can actually see a resemblance there. Anyway, my concern is, as hers is over there, that though they have become more aware of autism in this country and Australia, unfortunately, the money is not there for the research or the programs that are so essential for early detection and support through those years, which does not go away forever.
Wow, Anne, thanks a lot for the call. And two questions that come out of this for me, and maybe to you first, Julie. First of all, if you could just talk about, you know, services that are available, services that are a little harder to get. I'm wondering what schools are supposed to provide. I'm wondering what insurance companies are supposed to cover. I'm wondering how much parents have to, you know, foot the bill on their own.
Big question.
Yes.
So to answer it briefly for within the constraints of the radio show, schools need to provide when there's an educational need that gets determined by the child's individualized team. So if there's an evaluation and there isn't an educational need that's determined, then schools aren't required to provide anything above and beyond what they're providing for all kids. If a specific educational need is determined, then schools need to meet that individual's needs. As far as insurance companies, there is quite a movement going on across the United States right now in having insurance companies cover the cost of autism services, which is something that has not been in place for very long. Vermont just passed some legislation last year to require insurance companies to pay for autism services. And, you know, so where things are in the continuum of that across the United States, I don't have all of the numbers, but it's going on state by state right now, trying to get that to happen. And then once the legislation happens, there seems to be a lack of providers out there because it's something that hasn't existed in the past.
Yeah, and I know the insurance piece is huge. Yeah, go ahead, Julie.
And so related to both of those two things, therefore, if there is a need that the family sees that is currently not covered by insurance or is not going to be covered in the school services, then the family does have to pay out of pocket to get those services.
Do you want to jump
there
in?
There are some programs.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, sorry, Julie, go ahead.
There are some programs, there are some waivers, there are some things that families can qualify for, but to the extent that they don't, they are responsible to pay for the rest.
Yeah. Go ahead, Dr. Bullock, I'd like your thoughts on this too.
The New Hampshire Autism Council lobbied very hard and worked with the legislature to pass Connor's Law a few years ago, which guarantees coverage for individuals with autism, but only those insurance groups that are commercial groups are required to follow this law. So self-insured groups do not have to follow the law, nor does New Hampshire Medicaid, also known as Healthy Kids. So at this point, only about a third of the families have insurance coverage that is mandated to cover autism services. As with Vermont, New Hampshire has an in-home supports waiver that helps some families with children with autism, but this waiver is drastically underfunded, and there's a very long waiting list for families to access the care.
Well, and concerning services, schools, what they have to do, what they don't have to do, an email from Sandra in Chester, Vermont came in before the show. She says, my question comes from an experience with an IEP. That's an individualized education plan. Is that right? Okay. Written for a child with autism. I felt that autism was diagnosed and that the resulting IEP was written to fit the child's behavior into the diagnosis instead of identifying the child's strengths and creating a program around those strengths. Sandra says, I believe the answer is because of monetary issues and not what is best for the child achieving his or her best in the classroom. Could you please address this? Sandra, thank you for the email. What do you think about this, Julie? It's complicated trying to do the best for the kid in the schools, but there's costs involved as well.
It's really difficult because when we look at an IEP, we're talking about services that will eventually be funded by the federal government. But when I say eventually, it's because the services are provided and then the school districts have to have their accountability to say they provided those services to submit to the government, which then reimburses for those services 2 years after the fact. So, or sometimes in some cases more. And so what happens is that the school districts themselves are responsible within their budgets to lay the money out first for the services and then get reimbursed usually in a partial way much later. And so it's a challenge for school districts because when people say that, you know, there's a monetary consideration, well, there has to be. You know, schools are operating on budgets that are designed, as you know, by, you know, our voters, and so it's challenging.
Well, and that's the concern, right, Julie, about overdiagnosis. I mean, if you're labeling too many people as autistic, then that costs a lot more money. So there's a desire maybe to curtail that diagnosis. I wonder what you think, Julie.
In Vermont, we're a little bit unique because the diagnosis itself doesn't necessarily ensure services as much as it might in some other states. We have a pretty strict adverse effect language in our IEP. Legislation and the law that governs that. So that helps to really sort of reduce services just to.
Julie, you there? I think we lost Julie's line all of a sudden. Well, I've got an email that I did want to throw to you, Dr. Mott, so hopefully we'll get Julie back up with us. This is from Susie in Canaan, who says, do your guests think that the research suggesting a prenatal start to autism will help to relieve some parents' fears about a supposed link between autism and vaccines? Susie, thanks for that thought. And Dr. Mott, I'd like to hear from you on that.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. And yes, if one can know that the diagnosis occurs or in signs of that diagnosis from a neurobiological sense is present in utero, then yes, it's very obvious that it's not caused by something that's occurred after birth, like vaccines.
So that may be a relief for parents, as Susie says. Do you want to jump in on that too, Dr. Bullock?
I think it may help with the vaccine piece, but as a mother who works with mothers, I think we'll find a way to feel guilty no matter what. It's our genes if it's not our vaccines.
Well, let's go to our callers again, and I believe Julie is back with us. Hi, Julie, you there?
Hi, I'm here.
Okay, great. Sorry about that lost line there, and let's go to Tasha in Merrimack. Go ahead, Tasha, you're on The Exchange.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And
sure.
Thanks for the discussion. What has been of great benefit to my 8-year-old, who is on the spectrum, has been what is called a PBIS school. It's a network of schools, and I'm unfamiliar if it's just in New Hampshire or if it is nationwide, but it's a positive behavioral intervention and support, and it's simply a program that is instituted by the school through training and the approach of how they deal with children of autism or ADHD as well as other emotional and behavioral issues. They have a retreat room, and they also have paraeducators that monitor them throughout the day and help them cope with situations socially, most in particular, so that way they can focus on their academics. It's a tremendous program that I think more families need to advocate at their schools for them to institute, because it has made all the difference in the world of bringing my daughter from a terrible state of mind to thriving.
Wow. Good to hear a good story, Tasha. Thank you for calling. So, Dr. Bullock, this sounds like instead of saying we're going to help these kids this way and these kids this way, this seems like a system-wide approach that Tasha is talking about.
This is a wonderful program, and there is evidence-based of its effectiveness across the country. It is very, very well done here in New Hampshire and elsewhere. It also builds upon the strengths that I think Sandra mentioned her concerns that an IEP mentioned so much about strengths. One thing we know is that it's easier to strengthen strengths than it is to remediate weaknesses. So what PBIS does is it helps catch the kids being good. So then we build upon the things they are doing well, and in behavioral terms, reduce the probability that they'll have to use problem behavior to get their needs met.
Boy, that's the case with any kid, right? You're supposed to catch them being good, although sometimes it's hard to do that.
Could I?
Yes, go ahead, Julie.
I'd love to jump in on
that.
I see this as an example, too, of one of those things that traditionally in interventions for autism we've been doing for a very, very long time, using this positive reinforcement to encourage the behaviors we do want to see happening, has a direct effect on diminishing the behaviors we don't want to see happening, just from the child's effort to increase the reinforcement and increase the behaviors that we do want to see. And now they're taking that to all kids. You know, which is one of those things that I see as an intervention we've been using for a long time for autism that really works very well for everyone.
All right. Let's take another call. This is Miriam in Hanover. Oh, sure. Go ahead, Dr. Mott.
Yes. I think what dawns on me is hearing this increased incidence and numbers from the CDC, hearing the struggles that's occurring with the definition of what qualifies as for an IEP and not. Shouldn't this be part of the U.S. educational curriculum, social interactive studies? Should this be part of our what a first grader, what a second grader, what a middle schooler, what a high schooler receives in terms of social development?
Everybody.
And that be, yes. Because what Julie is doing, she says it's not just children with autism, it's children with social behavioral issues. This is what it speaks to.
Well, and Dr. Mott, I appreciate the point, and that's sort of where our caller was going and where Dr. Bullock was going. Mm-hmm. What about the cost, though, Dr. Mott? What do you think? I mean, right now we're sort of focusing on this group and this group and this group. You three seem to be saying, let's just have a comprehensive approach that can assist everyone, no matter what their issues. And yet I'm wondering about costs. I know this isn't quite your area of expertise, Dr. Mott, but I'm really curious as to what you think.
Well, I found when I moved from the Maryland, Virginia area up here that what was missing up here was the strength at the county level, where one would have a pool of resources of monies that could be distributed over different locales. Whereas up here, it's very much based on what the ability of a particular locale to afford. And there are very wealthy locations and school systems that provide excellent services. Yet there are some school systems that provide very poor services, substandard, that are actually against the federal regulations. And what I found in where I came from was that at the county level, one could have autism coordinators that could serve not only the wealthy schools in a certain county, but also the poorer schools. So there's a different tier level. Now, how to fund that? That isn't my expertise.
Yeah. Well, yes, and you're right. In other places, counties are bigger and have more control. And so in New Hampshire, it tends to be more town by town. Let's take one more call if we could. Miriam's waiting in your backyard, Dr. Mott, Hanover. Hi, Miriam. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. I am Iranian, and I have a son on spectrum. The last two times that I went to Iran, I took him with me, and he changed after 3 days over there. His eye contact came back. His language was better. He didn't speak gibberish much. And then the first time I saw the difference, I didn't think about it very much. The second time after 3 days, I realized it again, and that really got me curious. I asked him, "So how do you feel?" He goes like, "Well, Mom, I'm just cuckoo." But my son is very high functional, but he definitely showed some behavior on the spectrum. Now, I watched a movie about a family who went to, I believe, Mongolia, and they experienced kind of like change with their sons and everything. And so I asked a neurologist, he said something about altitude. Has there been any studies about altitude that has been helpful? Because
High altitudes helping.
Yeah, high altitudes.
All right, Miriam, I'm going to let you go for just a moment there. And anyone, Dr. Mott, have you heard about this? Her son does better in Iran.
I must say I haven't heard of this.
Yeah, and go ahead.
No, I really don't know what to add.
Well, and I think it just shows, and Miriam, thank you for the call. I think it just shows that we're still searching, right? I mean, we want to figure this thing out. One in 68 kids, it's a lot of kids, and we're just looking for answers there. So, Miriam, I really appreciate the call. I did want to ask you, Dr. Mott, any other emerging research on this issue of autism that you find interesting that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, I think there's a number of issues, but one that's near and dear to myself is the high incidence of epilepsy that's seen in children that fall on the autism spectrum. And in fact, this is an area that I have an expertise in. And why it's important to consider doing EEG studies to look at certain patterns of epileptic activity that occurs in a greater incidence amongst children with autism. So children that have had a regression, children that seem to space out, children that get lost in their own little world, one should actually consider doing EEGs, electroencephalograms, to rule out subtle types of seizure disorders.
Is that like an MRI or a type of brain scan? Is that what that is?
It's not a structural study like an MRI or a CAT scan. This is actually measuring the electrical activity of the brain.
I see.
And
okay.
Looking for hyper-excitable areas that could cause seizures.
Well, Dr. Mott, thank you very much for joining us. We know you're a busy guy. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I enjoyed this.
That's Dr. Stephen Mott, developmental cognitive neurologist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. And Julie Erdely, thank you also for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Julie Erdely, Program Manager for Communication Services at the Stern Center for Language and Learning in Williston, Vermont. And Dr. Teresa Bullock, thank you also for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you, and thank you, Julie and Dr. Mott.
Dr. Teresa Bullock, psychologist and behavior analyst specializing in autism spectrum disorders. The Exchange is a production of NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, a new gas tax. Last week, the House voted in favor of a Senate bill raising the tax by 4 cents a gallon, and Governor Hassan has said she'll sign it. We'll look at the implications of the state's first gas tax increase in 23 years. Then later, we'll explore the debate over adding sexual orientation as a protected group under the state's constitution. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 here on New Hampshire Public Radio. New Hampshire weather mostly cloudy today, high temperatures in the 50s, and cloudy tonight, lows in the 30s, then becoming partly sunny tomorrow with highs again in the 50s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from HealthSouth Rehabilitation Hospital in Concord, helping individuals return to active, independent lives through comprehensive medical rehabilitation services, healthsouthconcord.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. In the U.S., there are many laws on the books to protect animals from abuse. But a group of lawyers is trying to take animal rights a huge step further. Led by longtime animal advocate Stephen Wise, the Non-Human Rights Project filed